Okay, one final question, hopefully final question, is now those of us who have seen Rambo movies, a lot of what you described is very similar, particularly in the first film when he had a POW trying to bring him out the last minute, they would not allow it to happen. Is any of the inspiration for that film coming from you?
Oh yes, sir. We first came back from East Asia. Sylvester Stallone made Rambo. Of course, Sylvester Stallone, doctors, you'll appreciate, was not a Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Zurich, as a matter of fact, to avoid the draft, and worked as an aerobics instructor at a girls' school there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is, he's made hundreds of millions of dollars off of the Vietnam veteran image. When we were training Afghans out here in southern Nevada, he came up with, his Rambo, whatever it was, about Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
In one way, I sort of wish he would have an original thought.
Has he?
In a way, I'm glad that Stallone is doing what he's doing because it helps raise awareness. I'm not a movie star. There's no way.
Has he contacted you or talked to you about any of your exploits?
MIA, Uncommon Valor, and Rambo, and you put them all together, what they have done is taken everything that has come out of the news and then they've made a movie about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you shuffle them together, you get almost a true picture of exactly what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
but it is awareness, and it's something that that is good. It does bring America, because we, for some reason or other, we have a tendency to believe what we see in these Hollywood productions.
Well, now that you are seriously working to eradicate all of us in America of the drug problem, what do you expect the government to do towards you?
Well, they tried to prosecute me again. They promised me that, oh, if you don't erase and forget, if you don't cooperate, you'll serve 15 years a felon. We will bring, quote, aggravated charges and hostile witnesses. We have four filing cabinets full of covert operations. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
I have misused passports. I've been behind enemy lines. I've been in covert operations for 30 years. They gave me their best shot. And what they did is they lost a U.S. attorney, they lost a chief deputy, and an assistant. And I'm still a free man.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a time to be faint-hearted, doctor. It's a time to be valiant, to stand up for what is right. If we're right and right enough, we'll win. And if needs be, to hell with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and could you give, I understand, well, before you give that number, that 800 number out again, I understand you have a book and videos that people could write for or call for.
Oh, you bet. In the packet there is a, what happened, Green Berets aren't supposed to write, doctor. Our knuckles are supposed to drag the ground. But I couldn't get tried. The Constitution says fair and speedy trial, but after 2 years of delaying for one administrative reason after another, I finally, and under order from the judge that said, if you divulge any of this information, it'll be contempt of court. I was in contempt. I wrote a book that literally printed every document that the judge said we couldn't present during the trial, and it's called A Nation Betrayed, and then the videotapes that we gave the White House are all available. I'm not going to, everything I have is for America and public use. And so in the feedback is information on exactly how anyone who's interested can get just as smart as they want to get. They have everything I've got on this issue. The number is simply 1-800-828-6960. And if you call, I'm on the same time zone as you are. If you call during daylight hours, we have live people there. If you call right now or during the darkness, for example, after hours, then you'll have a recording. But if you leave your name and your address, then we will send it out first-class mail so that you'll get it just as quick as Uncle Sam will deliver it.
Well, Colonel, I want to thank you very much, not only with talking with us and revealing the information that you have, but continuing to do the work that you're doing. And I'm sure many of us thank you with all of our hearts.
Well, Doctor, this is our country, and they may bury us. By golly, we're not going to run.
Well, thank you very much, Colonel Bo Greitz.
God bless you.
You've been listening to a 1991 interview of Bo Greitz, a former Special Forces operative. The interviewer was Professor Kwaku Person Len. This is Unwelcome Guests. Our opening segment in the program regarding the railroading of dozens of people on bogus drug charges in Tulia, Texas, highlights two aspects of our society. One is that, on numerous documented occasions, law enforcement officials have lied under oath, fabricated evidence, and railroaded people into jail in order to fulfill their professional agenda or the political agenda of their superiors. This and other types of corruption, such as operating burglary and drug rings by law enforcement, have happened so often that it seems time to acknowledge that such activities are more systemic and less aberrant than is usually portrayed. And the second aspect is that, in spite of dishonesty by police and other government officials and functionaries, the statement of any person employed in law enforcement is taken as more credible by society at large than a person accused of crime. Why? Could it be social wishful thinking to attribute greater truthfulness to police officers and prison guards because we hope that people who have been given the powers they've been given are persons of integrity? Last month, the New York State Prison in Auburn was put in lockdown after prison authorities claimed that prisoners had attempted to assault guards. The story was reported only from the point of view of the authorities. Next, you'll hear the other side of the story from Chacon, a man incarcerated in Auburn. Chacon is one of the many people now behind bars because of the war on drugs. I would ask you to consider these questions. Why is a person who decides to ingest marijuana, cocaine, or some other illegal drug less credible than a person who decides to ingest beer or vodka? Why is it okay to subject a person who decides to ingest an illegal drug to years and decades of torture? The interviewer is Dee LeConte from CKUT in Montreal.
I have a collect call from
Chacon,
an inmate at Auburn Correctional Facility, a New York State correctional facility.
The following is an interview with Chacon, a prisoner at Auburn Penitentiary in Auburn, New York, a maximum penitentiary that holds over 1,800 prisoners. Recently, media sources reported on a lockdown that took place at Auburn Penitentiary, which began on June 14, 2003, and was lifted on June 22. Mass media received all their information about the lockdown and the incident leading up to it from prison authorities, who stated that a group of prisoners approached a few officers in the exercise yard and began hitting them. Prisoner Chacon will explain that for some time leading up to the June 14th incident, some guards at the penitentiary had been planting weapons in various prisoner cells. The cells were then searched, and the prisoners in these cells were thrown into segregation, the box, and subsequently found guilty of possessing weapons. The planting of these weapons by guards had been going on in Auburn since the end of May. Prisoners became aware of which guards were responsible for these illegal activities. Chacon also explains how the incident in the yard actually unfolded.
It started the beginning of June, the very, very beginning, maybe a little end of May, around like the 25th or so. They started by planting weapons in individual cells and saying that they were there and taking these guys to the box, you know, and other prisoners was fed up with that and, you know, begin to ask higher up officers why, like lieutenants, captains, when they see them, yo, why is this going on? And, you know, we're not giving off any problems or agitations. Why is this going on when, you know, even if an officer has a personal problem with someone, that's not the route. You know what I mean? they have methods and to do what they have to do or what they feel they have to do, but that's not one of them, you know what I mean? And that right there causes for a prisoner to have to stay in prison longer because they give out consecutive new sentences for this. You go back to court and everything for that, you know? So it's like a process. It's like a way to keep people in prison, you know? So that was the starter. And a few prisoners got together and collectively approached a lieutenant on the issue about, you know, certain officers being involved in this little setup thing. And, you know, they voiced their opinions and things got out of control because while they were speaking to the lieutenant, other officers came and began pushing and shoving the prisoners that were speaking. You know, when they push, prisoners push back. And they made it into a real big thing, a big ordeal, saying the security, and they started locking the jail now consecutively, a week at a time. They would open it back up, you know, to feed the prisoners, and then shut it back down when they feel that they can provoke another prisoner. I've seen it.
Chacon speaks of an incident with a guard that happened on the day before this interview, on June 24th, 2003.
In fact, yesterday, coming back from the yard, the guy came back and the officer pulled him to the side out of the whole bunch and waited till everyone continuously went in. And next thing you know, this guy is screaming. They're beating him, like five of them. He got handcuffs on him. When you put handcuffs on a prisoner, why are you still beating him? He can't be resisting because he has handcuffs on him behind his back. What is this, some type of torture method by hitting him in his face and in his head where he can't cover up or what? You know, they took him off. And you know, he was in my area. He's gone now. You know, the day before that, which should have been June 24th, I believe. Another guy, they called him and told him he was next. And, you know, they came and got him. He was screaming. He's in his cell. You hear him screaming. So that, you know, that right there makes, honestly, a lot of prisoners, the inside become on a real defensive side. Because they don't know whether these officers are going to attack them. So they have to stand and protect themselves, I feel. I know I'm not going to allow them just to beat me up without trying to protect myself the best way I know how, even if I'm in a no-win situation. You know, and, these are the things that's going on here in Auburn and other facilities. You know, it's I don't know, man, it's really hard to cope with. I mean, I don't see anybody coping with that. You know, three shots was fired in the yard on the Saturday, which was June 14th, the day before Father's Day, and that's the day they really, really locked it down and took it all out. They started searching everything and taking dudes were just mysteriously leaving on, you don't see them no more. A lot of guys here that's gone now. You don't even know what happened to them. You know, a brother up in the box right now. And fortunately, like when we go to the yard, he's able to call out the window and we can hear him in the yard. He's telling us he's been up there now for 7 days. They haven't fed him anything. He has no water in his cell. You know, and these inhumane ways, man can't live like that. You know, it's a constant thing. It's constant. The officers are moving around in packs, literally, three, five at a time, to pull one prisoner over to search him or take him inside where he can't be observed by other prisoners, take him inside and supposedly searching him, and he may come back out beat up, taking him across to the box, because they have to walk across the yard to the box. He may come back out, beat up, going to the box. I mean, it's really, really becoming crazy, really crazy. The weapon setting, you know, planting weapons, it really bothers me because I was a victim of that. It happened to me before. And I know that when they do that, criminal procedures come after that. So a guy can be, possibly have a chance to get ready to go home, and this is planted on him, and he has to go to court to defend himself, which, you know, it's like a no-win situation because you're already in prison, and they're saying you're promoting prison contraband by having a weapon, and they give you additional time.
Chacon explains how prisoners are put into segregation, also known as the box, as soon as contraband or weapons are found in their cells. Since the recent cases of weapons found in the cells at Auburn Penitentiary, which were planted by the guards, one can understand why some prisoners became very frustrated over this overt illegal activity committed by those in authority.
From the time that the weapon or any incident takes place, you go straight to the box or you get locked in. Can't come out. Now, a ticket, an infraction, misbehavior report, whichever one is wished to be called, comes probably the next day. And day after that or so, assistants come. And within the next, they have 7 days to start the hearing. If it's a tier two, they have different tiers in these misbehavior reports. A tier two is like a misdemeanor, and a tier three is like a felony. You understand? So, they got 7 days to come and start your hearing on a tier two, but the tier three is the most effective. Those are the ones that send you to the box prior. So, I'm going to speak about those. They have 14 days to start them. So you can sit in the box for 14 days before they even take you to your hearing. When they take you to your hearing, you know, you're able to call witnesses, the witnesses being the officers or a few prisoners. And 20 times out of 10, they'll let you know that they feel that your witnesses are coming on your behalf, giving statements that's contrived already. So, you know, they're going to believe, 20 out of 10, they believe what the officer tells them, you know. So, you're found guilty. If you're found guilty, anywhere from 90 days, 2 years, or whatever. Incident that happened with, that they claim was an uprising in the yard. Same brother that's telling us, calling us from the window, that's telling us that, he has no water and they're not feeding him. He has 7.5 years in lockdown now. You know, tier three, you're out of here. You're going straight to the box. There's no returning to the same facility most of the time. An officer does the hearing. An officer writes the ticket, an officer does the hearing. Not the same officer, but, you know, they eat lunch together. You know what I mean? So it's like you're in a no-win situation regardless. It's very rare that someone beats these hearings. These hearings are one-sided. Very unjust. So, you know, it's a continuous thing. And they take $5 out of your account for each one that you get and you're found guilty of. This is another reason why they're set up for you to be found guilty, because they get $5 from you. So they don't want to lose the $5. And it's like it's in the officer's head, officers around the facility, you know, the more tickets we write, the more money we can get from these guys. You understand? So that's a big factor to me that I see too, you know, because they constantly write tickets. It can be for small stuff or it can be for big stuff. It's like the $5 is really, it's really like a push for them, you know. I don't know if they use the $5 for their union or whatever, because I don't see where the $5 goes for anything for, you know, prison population or anything of that. So, the crazy. It's really crazy.
Chacon explains the different jobs at the prison and how much money prisoners get paid. His explanation puts into perspective what a $5 fine means to prisoners financially.
Say, for instance, we have a lot of different jobs here that they give to keep the facility running. You know, they have an industry here. The industry here is license plates. New York City, New York State's license plates. And those license plates are made by prisoners, and those prisoners may get 25 cents an hour. Or, you know, up from 25 cents to 45 cents an hour to make the license plate for New York State. They also make desks and things for office buildings, corporate America. They make desks for those. They get 15 cents, 20 cents, things like that, an hour. And, you know, $5 is a lot up against them wages. You know, these are jobs that if one would have in society, they would be getting paid, you know, probably $30 an hour. You know, so in my eyes, it's modern day slavery due to this fact. And it's like, they'll put you down for overtime to work. If you wish not to work, you'll get locked up and get a ticket for that. Something they call mandatory overtime. You know? So it's like you have no choice in the matter of working. If you refuse to even take a program, which is what they call it, you'll get locked up for that. It's like it's mandatory for you to work in prison. The mess hall, for instance. That guys down in the mess hall that work, the lowest pay in the mess hall is $12 every 2 weeks, which would be about 12 cents an hour. From 12 cents an hour to 16, from 16 to 25 cents an hour. And that's the highest you're going to go. You know, they expect this to be a big thing, that pay. Those are peanuts, nothing. Those are really nothing at all. And they have the nerve to take $5 from you for that, for a ticket. They take money out of your account for any and every little thing that they possibly can take it for. Books. If you go to the library and get a book, you got a late fee for bringing the book back. It's money with this thing here. Everything is like they wish to take, and they take it right out of your account. So it's no argument, arguing about it, anything. When you look at your account again, it's automatically gone. To me, it's like a big money thing, and slavery is still in effect in prison.
Chacon speaks of how the media reported on the lockdown at Auburn Penitentiary, which began on June 14th.
When the incident took place on June 14th, the next day they had a news interview with, I guess, the facility here. The facility claimed that two gangs were trying to take over the facility, and they attacked the officers. I mean, that's not the truth in no shape, form, or fashion. Prior to this interview, before the incident took place, the deputy security here was asked in a news article, was there any gangs in Auburn? Says no. So, you know, he lied and was made look of a fool when he turned back around and said two gangs tried to take over the facility. He says, they said eight officers were badly hurt. More prisoners was hurt than anything because these officers walk around with oak sticks. These prisoners had nothing. They had nothing. The only thing they can do was try their best to protect themselves or, you know, cover their heads from being bust open. The media tries, they make sure to make society feel that it's even been done to me, you know. Just recently, 2 days ago, an officer came to me and told me I was next, you know, and just because of the color of my cell, you know, my sheets or my towels, they're red. And by them being that color, you're automatically labeled a gang member. I mean, you know, I don't have time for that. I'm trying to come home, so, you know, he feels that I'm that. And he's constantly pushing a lot of buttons with me. And I kind of like tend to ignore it and go about it the right way. You know, I've broken the officer up, and now he's become more aggressive. So, I'm not going to allow them to hurt me in any type of way. I'm going to protect myself in any shape, form, or fashion. I have to, you know. And if he puts his hands on me in any type of form or fashion, I will protect myself. They have a real bad problem with putting their hands on prisoners as if they're dealing with children and not grown men, or if they're dealing with people they see as being inferior to them, way under them. The way they speak is as such. Like, you're stripped of all your humanness, as much as you can, as much as they can do to you. You know, a man is not gonna go for that or feel that. He's gonna step up. Any man that has pride inside is not gonna allow anyone to speak to him in a disrespectful manner, because you can't speak to them disrespectful. They have a charge here that they write in misbehavior reports about abusive language, but constantly you're cursed at and talked to as somebody would talk to an animal or a dog. You know, like I said, it's a big injustice and a real lopsided justice here. Just because you're in prison do not make you an animal. Doesn't make you an animal. You know, like myself, I'm a product of drugs, the war on drugs. You know, and I'm still, it's no discrimination. You're a prisoner, you're in prison, you'll get talked to and treated as an animal. Bottom line, this is the attitude that is instilled in these officers in the academy. You know, keep them down. They're animals. I don't see that. I'm not going to allow them to speak to me or treat me as such as much as I can. This is why I stay in the box, because I don't allow that. I'm not going to allow them to strip me totally of my belief and what I feel. I refuse to. And they hate rebellion towards anything that they're trying to do.
Chacon explains what is the box, also known as SHUs and Supermax prisons.
Okay, the box is administration segregation from the population. Anytime you go to the box, well, you know, it's the box. Some guys say the box. Some say the hole. You know, some say SHU, which is the special housing unit. That's what those letters stand for. It's 23-hour lockdown. Well, really 24 hours now, because they have these new supermaxes that's nothing but administrative segregation. And you're in there 24 hours, you know, and they have the nerve to put you in there with another person. So it's like you are constantly in handcuffs. Whenever you come out of your cell, you're in handcuffs. Two officers, sticks out. You know, if you move the wrong way, you're hit or taken down, as they say. So it's a big difference between a supermax prison and SHU, because every prison in the state has a SHU. Everyone. It's a wing that's off to the side that, when disciplinary actions or any type of disciplinary proceedings are go on, you go there because you know, they feel that you are a threat to population or individuals in population, period, or officers, whatever. You're a threat, so you're automatically segregated from general population. So that's what SHU is, Special Housing Unit.
He Here, Chacon explains from his 3-year experience in the Supermax prison called Upstate in Malone, New York, and what he did to mentally survive there.
Upstate was the biggest, during my time being in prison, and I've been in prison going on 9 years now. Mentally wise, it can really, really break you down. Now, me personally, I stayed there 3 years. The way I dealt with it mentally was feeding my brain knowledge from books, reading a lot of books, and becoming abreast of a lot of things that's going on in the world and things that went on in history. That's the way I did it. It's not very much you can do but read to, like, deter your mind from the true reality of what's going on. Physically, I've seen a lot more harshness go on in Upstate Correctional Facility, which is SHU. The whole population, the whole thing is SHU. And I've seen a lot of things go on there that was very horrible. Very. I've seen tear gas go inside on brothers. I've seen a lot of beatings given out by officers in Upstate. Physically, they will hurt you very, very bad due to the fact that whenever you're out your cell, no matter where you're going, you have handcuffs and a chain around your waist. So it's no movement whatsoever for your hands. And like I said, they don't have a problem with hitting you with their sticks while you're in chains. You know, they have a lot of cameras there, but that's not of any help. You know, these people, they modify tapes and do whatever they wish to make you seem like you're the bad guy in the situation. Well, like the supermax that you're speaking on, such as Upstate, there's no moving around, period. You cannot go anywhere unless it's to a visit, or like if your family comes see you, or you have a medical call out or something like that. So, your movement is restricted, period. Whereas that, like in a regular max, you can move around, and most of the time, it's like work. So you're denied, let's say, contact visits, because in a supermax prison, you have to be behind a gate, a cage. You're literally in a cage while your family is on the other side of the cage. And opposed to being in a regular max like here in Auburn, you know, you're in contact with your family without the cage or so forth. To me personally, anytime you put anyone in a cage of any shape, form, or fashion is mentally abusing. You know, sometimes it affects younger brothers and really make them begin to feel as if they're an animal. And to me, prisons breed violence. They breed violence. You make a person agitated and you're constantly pushing him into a violent state of mind because you're constantly oppressing him. So, you know, there's a lot of things you can't. You can't have anything from home, you know, besides periodicals and books. You know, so you can't have any type of personal belongings whatsoever while you're in Supermax, the box, or SHU, whatever you wish to describe it as. Phone calls are none at all. You cannot have any phone calls from Supermax prison. Any. No. It's like a disciplinary proceeding. A disciplinary sanction happens to be no phone, no packages, no commissary. things to deter your family from even dealing with you as much as they can. You can't have no type of phone calls in Supermax prison.
Chacon gives a description of the cells at upstate Supermax prison where he was incarcerated for 3 years. He explains the extraction technique that guards use to get prisoners out of their cells. Chacon also speaks of a vegetable loaf that is given as punishment.
So first of all, it's a room with a big metal door that slides back and forth. My extraction was due to the fact that when they took me to the Supermax prison in 2000 of June, when it first opened up, they were trying to put Bunky in there, another prisoner in the cell with me. And to me, that's inhumane to be in an area that small, let's say a 9x10, with another individual 24 hours a day, because you can't leave out, you can't go anywhere. You get your 1 hour rec in the cell. So I stood up against that. And, you know, they came with the extraction team. The extraction team consists of the biggest, strongest officers in the facility. And, you know, they're dressed up in all black, like weapon-resistant suits and helmets and batons. And they stand outside the cell while a lieutenant sprays gas, pepper spray, into the cell on you, and, you know, try to get you to, you know, cough and your eyes begin to run. You know, they turn your water off so you can't get it out of your eyes. And then when they feel they have enough in there, they run in there with gas masks on and subdue you and beat you as if you were resisting, because there's no cameras in the cell. So when they run in the cell, they can pretty much do anything they want to do to you. One guy, I remember, they extracted him, ran in the cell, and they literally dragged him out with his face scraping the floor. And the floor is like a concrete, ragged concrete. They scraped his face up really bad. He had a lot of scrapes on his face. You know, they take you to medical attention for a little while, and, you know, that same day you're back in that same cell. Or maybe a cell next to it, because sometimes they have to air it out with a fan to try to get the chemicals that was used out of the area as much as they can. But the thing is, man, you can be right next door, and they extracting someone, and the vents are connected, so it'll come in the next cell. It irritate me. I can have bronchitis, asthma, and that can really harm a person that has that, because it hinders your breathing. So it's a lot of torture in that to me. The biggest torture, physically and mentally to me, that they do is they have a disciplinary sanction they give where they put a guy on what they call a loaf. They give this guy a loaf. The loaf consists of flour, cabbage, and carrots. They give this to an individual 3 times a day with nothing else, just that loaf of bread. That's torture. I mean, and they give you this when, like, you're getting ready to go home, maybe, and they can't give you any more time in a Supermax prison. They give you this as a disciplinary sanction. Like I said before, that's not a punishment. That's torture. You know, I call it the black bread. That was used as a torture method a long time ago. Inhumane, period. They give you that 3 times a day, but nothing else. Just that. But as a matter of fact, they give you a cup of cabbage, shredded up cabbage. I've seen many guys on that. On this loaf that, you know, they refuse to eat it. But how long can you go without eating? You can't go weeks on weeks without eating. So, you know, it's really that method, the methods that they tend to use are really crazy. On the same issue, they put an article out on it, because so many people have wrote it up. They put an article out on it. The system was saying that they were just giving out to guys that throw feces give it to just those guys. That's a disciplinary sanction for anyone that they feel they cannot punish any longer any other way. You know what I mean? So this is a method that they feel as it being a punishment, but I see it as a torture, a way of torturing someone mentally and physically, because you can't eat that, and you can't go without eating. So, you know, they're trying to break you down physically as well as mentally as much as they can. They give it to you for like 7 days straight, and they'll take you off for 2 days, and then, you know, you'll get it again for another 7 days. The longest I ever seen them give somebody that was, I think, 45 days straight. And, you know, the guy had to go out to the hospital. Then 2 weeks, he had to go to the hospital. You know, so they have various time frames they give you. Depends on the ticket. 7 days is the least that I've ever seen anyone get it. And that's too long. My eyes, that's way too long.
Chacon speaks of the disproportionate amount of Black and Latino prisoners in the prison system. He also speaks about the laws concerning crack and powder cocaine.
Supermax prisons and prisons all over, the population generally consists of Blacks and Latinos. I say here, I think it's about 90% are colored origin. I'm saying color origin to say Blacks and Latinos. And to me, in my eyes, I see them all as one because they're treated as the minority anyway. So the focus is on that. The boxes, the SHUs are 95% Black and Latino. It's very seldom you see brother of white sent in the boxes unless it's for drug use or anything like that. It's never really violent unless that individual is just a stand-up individual. I'm not saying the number is very small, but the focus is Blacks and Latinos. You know, it's like that in the street, in society, and the prisons are full, way overpopulated. You know, it's like that's the focus of the society. Prison population up high with Blacks and Latinos in USA right now. I say it's like 90%. It may be a little higher, but I'm just gonna say 90% as the minimum. I'm gonna give you a prime example. It's a law out right now. I don't really know the number of it, but I can basically quote it like for crack cocaine, you get a way higher sentence for crack cocaine than you would for regular powder cocaine. And if you really look at the difference in that, being that the majority of crack handlers or crack users are Black or Latino. The majority of the people that handles and uses powdered cocaine are white. You know, the sentence is not a little bit lesser, but way lesser. Whereas that a person that has a small amount of crack cocaine, he can get anywhere from 5 years to 10 years, and opposed to a person with powdered cocaine, he can get from 2 years to 5 years. You know, so that in itself shows me that the judicial system is racist in that being. Me personally, you know, I'm not gonna say that I didn't do what I was doing because, I was selling drugs from young, you know, and to me that was like the only way that I could survive as far as having money then. I'm still in prison 9 years now due to that, along with the inside charges I received for promoting prison contraband. I feel like maybe the sentence was lesser, I wouldn't even still be in prison because I would have never had the prison contraband. Everything is like a rippling effect. It's like dominoes. Come to prison, for a short term when you really shouldn't even be in prison. The Rockefeller law, I mean, you know, that's the biggest law now that's trying to oppose that law as we speak. The law is very, very racist. You know, you have a lot of blacks and Latinos that were drug users that's in prison for having very small amounts of crack cocaine. But at the same time, a white person can have powder cocaine and he's gonna get half of what that crack cocaine to give you. The price of crack is way under the price of cocaine, so you know, that lets me know that minorities was targeted in that drug. They know that it's cheaper, and they know that blacks and Latins are more likely to have that because it's cheaper.
Chacon speaks about economical differences between people of color and white people and how that affects who goes to prison.
The economical differences are astronomical because the average black or Latino, where I live at, you know, they were either welfare or had small-time jobs that barely paid their rent and put food on the table. So, you know, it was maybe a step above poverty, or maybe it was really poverty. And that right there made a lot of us feel that we had to turn to the streets and do the things that we did, you know, to survive. It's a constant oppressive state due to the fact that, you know, the money situation. You see a lot of younger people feel they have to have things that they want. It's not necessarily a need, but things they want. And we constantly try to do whatever we have to do to get those things that we want. And it's out there by society like that. Because there's no help awarded in any type, shape, form, or fashion, because you can't go and get a job paying $40,000 a year. It's way harder than it would for a minority, a black or Latino, than it would be for a white person to get that job. You know, schooling. We're forced to drop out of school at a young age to try, you know, to get money. You know, it's just real hard. You know, so I don't know. It's even hard to explain sometimes until I really sit down and really, really think about it. It's really hard to explain.
Chacon speaks about the prison industrial complex in the United States.
The United States is like a police state in my eyes. Saying that to say that the prison, you know, the focus is prison. If you really check, if anyone really check, the prison industry is one of the biggest. I believe maybe arms is the biggest over here. Arms sales is the biggest over here. So, you know, it's either second or third, you know. But still, it's still extremely high. And it's being done by wronging towards other people, oppressing other people. So, you know, I tend to focus on that due to the fact that it affects me and the people around me, opposed to the car dealers and things of that nature. So, you know, I don't want to get anybody mixed up on that issue. You know, so it's in between. I tell you, it's in the top five, actually in the top three, and that's astronomical, right? So. And it's really bad. It's really bad. They want to keep the economical system going. They want to keep generating money for themselves. So by doing that, even if they have to step on the smaller or keep blacks and Latins down to keep continuously generating that money, they will. Just like, you know, they make it so there's no good time here. So there's no getting out early. They want you to stay in prison as long as they can keep you here, because that is money to them. It's no change in that fact. I see it, and I know a lot of other people see it, and they just refuse to really look at it. No matter how much covering up they do, it's not even being covered up no more, because they're being blatant with it now. Yeah, we're locking you up, and you're gonna stay there, and we're gonna make money off of you. and you go to work. You know, so they're not hiding anymore. I just wish people open their eyes and see it for what it really is.
Chacon speaks on the monopoly of the MCI telephone service in prisons.
Right now, all the prisons over here in USA, MCI handles that. And the call rating here is really high. I'm going to tell you how high it is and how much, like, not how much MCI is into corporate America in this prison complex due to the fact that they have a lot of stocks in prison, MCI phone company. The buses that transport prisoners, MCI donated them to prison. It has MCI over the cross of the bus. So, you know, everybody's benefiting off of prison as much as they can. The ratings are astronomical. Right now, there's a lot of prisoners that have lawsuits in against MCI and the outstanding bills they give people for them calls. I don't know if they know what the outcome of it as of yet, but, you know, MCI has a real big stop in American prisons, and it's really bad. It's really bad.
Here, Chacon suggests an alternative to incarceration for victims of the war on drugs.
A lot of drug-related offenses were for people that was using drugs and maybe selling it to support their habits. So, you know, they say prisons, they give out this false facade that prisons are rehabilitation processes. There's no rehabilitation here. You know, they have drug treatment programs that really, really focuses on drug treatment and rehabilitation. Those right there alone should be another avenue for prisoners that's victimized by the war on drugs. You know, that's the biggest and most effective alternative that I can even think about. They have a kingpin law here. Those are the guys that they feel supposed to stay in prison because they wasn't utilizing drugs. They were just selling them. So, you know, but those that's under that, I feel the biggest alternative, the best alternative, it's drug rehabilitation centers that focus on that to truly get these people ready for society when they come out and, you know, deter them from the usage or just to deter them from drugs, period.
In the following, Chacon shares with us his thoughts on marijuana use.
Marijuana, I don't see that as being a drug, period, man. I mean, I know a lot of people that really, really meditate off of marijuana. Marijuana is used as a medicine. Like my great-grandmother and my grandmother, they used that as tea, to drink as tea when they were sick. I don't see that as a criminal drug at all. I don't even see it as being a drug because it's natural. Not too many prisoners are here for a long time for drug selling or drug use. But you go to the box here for that, period. Anything dealing with marijuana, you go straight to the box. The usage of it, selling of it, anything, possession of it, anything. You know, when I was in the street, I caught a case for possession of marijuana, and they wasn't even too bothered with it. But I had a lot of it. I received a year for that. I don't know, man. I'm really like biased when it comes to marijuana. Very much so. Because I don't see it killing anyone. I don't see it killing anyone at all. Opposed to, like, let's say, alcohol. Alcohol kills a lot of people, whether it be a drunken driving or health reasons. So, my eyes, I don't think that should be illegal. Like I'm saying, alcohol is way deadlier than that.
Chacon suggests what outside communities can do to help prisoners. Unfortunately, the guards came to take him away. He was not able to finish his answer.
The best thing I can say, like, help the brothers keep their sanity, you know, as much as they can, because by them turning away, by people turning away from their families and whatever, whoever they have in prison, I mean, I'm quite sure if you're black or Latin, some way, shape, form, or fashion, this prison industry has affected your family. I don't really believe that no one's untouched by this. The support, the mental support, is like the biggest thing for me. Because you have a lot of brothers here that, you know, people have walked away and turned their backs because they're naive to the whole prison system by believing what society or what the media is giving them on it. So, you know, the support, the mental support, if not financial support, but more sort of mental support. You know, write a letter. It's nothing to sit down and write a letter and, you know, let that person know that they're being thought about. Their presence is missed. You know, if he can come see him, that's even better because that gives the administration, that lets them know that somebody out there on the outside cares about this individual being in prison. So, you know, sometimes that would make them think twice about really doing something to someone opposed to a person that gets no mail, no visits. You know, they may feel that nobody's going to miss him if we hurt him. You understand? So, show support to anybody that you have in prison. You know, write them a letter. Let them know they thought about. You know, that's like the biggest picker-upper that a prisoner can get. They know that he has some mail. He get a piece of mail and somebody misses him or her. A lot of people have turned away from this because brothers have maybe 25 years of life and, you know, it's a chance that he may not see the street again. Okay, so maybe it's a chance he may not see the street again, but you can still see him. He can still see you, or she can still see you. Support these people, man. They're needed. A lot of people is trying to fight their cases in the courts. Oppose it. Those that don't have anyone here, they have I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's very easy to look people up, prisoners up on the internet nowadays. You know, if you wish, all right, I have to, yes, they just came and got me. I have to make a run.
You've been hearing the voice of Chacon, a prisoner at the state penitentiary in Auburn, New York, speaking on June 25th about the situation inside the prison. Thanks to Dee LeConte for that tape. And thank you for listening to Unwelcome Guests. For more info on the program or to contact us, please visit our website at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
By unwelcome travelers.